glanced at the book, or maybe not at all. He conveyed the belief that improvising was his strength. He could read a situation, or the room, or the moment, as he had during the presidential campaign. Trump liked to do things spur of the moment, Porter concluded, to fly by the seat of his pants. He acted like doing too much advance preparation would diminish his skills in improvising. He did not want to be derailed by forethought, as if a plan would take away his power, his sixth sense. What the president would bring up in the morning most often was what he had seen on television, especially Fox News, or something from the newspapers he read more thoroughly than the public generally knew. Throughout the day, Trump would seek opinions from anyone who might be around, from cabinet officials to security guards. It was his form of crowdsourcing. He once asked Johnny McEntee, his 27-year-old body man, if he should send more troops to Afghanistan. "Doesn't make any sense to me," McEntee said. When Trump asked others in the West Wing, they often ducked. "I think you really ought to talk to HR about that, because he's the expert." "No, no, no," Trump said once. "I want to know what you think." "I know what I read in the newspapers." That was insufficient for the president. "No, I want to know what you think." All presidencies are audience-driven, but Trump's central audience was often himself. He kept giving himself reviews. Most were passionately positive. Much of his brain was in the press box. The operations of the Oval Office and White House were less the art of the deal and more often the unraveling of the deal. The unraveling was often right before your eyes, a Trump rally on continuous loop. There was no way not to look. In foreign affairs, it was about personal relationships, Trump explained to those who spent the most time in the Oval Office. "I have really good relations with Xi," he said about the Chinese president. "We have really good chemistry. Xi likes me. Xi rolled out the red carpet when I visited Beijing." In November 2017, he had said publicly, "I consider him a friend. He considers me a friend." H.R. McMaster tried to explain that Xi was using the president. China was an economic aggressor, planning to become number one in the world. Trump said he understood all of that, but all of those problems were superseded by his rapport with Xi. In the last 4 months of 2017, the United Nations Security Council had voted 3 times to impose stiffer economic sanctions on North Korea. On December 22nd, the vote was 15-0, including China. The sanctions were to cut the amount of petroleum that could be imported into North Korea by 89%. Trump was quite pleased. "That's because I developed such a great relationship with President Xi," he said, "and because he respects me and I respect him. And isn't it good that I'm friendly when all you guys say that we should be adversarial with them? Because if I didn't have that great relationship with President Xi, they never would have done that." It was the chemistry, the trust, so that I can get them to do things that they wouldn't otherwise do. On matters in which Trump had developed decades of opinions, arguments were pointless. One of the most experienced West Wingers in 2017 and 2018 said, "There's some things where he's already reached the conclusion, and it doesn't matter what you say. It doesn't matter what arguments you offer. He's not listening." At one point, Trump said he had decided to impose tariffs. "Great," Cohn said. "The stock market will be down 1,000 or 2,000 points tomorrow, but you'll be happy, right, sir?" "No, no, meeting's over. Let's not do anything." "Your biggest fear is being Herbert Hoover," Cohn said. It was Groundhog Day on trade again. Same arguments, same points, same certainty on both sides. The next week or next month, they would have the same discussion. Trump repeatedly said he was going to get out of the trade deals and impose tariffs. Several times he said, "Let's do it," and asked for an order to sign. "We've got to distract him from CORUS," Porter said to Cohn. "We've got to distract him from NAFTA." Cohn agreed. At least twice, Porter had the order drafted as the president had directed. and at least twice, Cohn or Porter took it from his desk. Other times, they just delayed. Trump seemed not to remember his own decision because he did not ask about it. He had no list in his mind or anywhere else of tasks to complete. On July 12, 2017, 15 former chairs of the Council of Economic Advisers, the high-powered formal advisory group of academic economists, had sent a letter to Trump urging him not to initiate the process of imposing steel tariffs because it would harm relations with key allies and actually damage the U.S. economy. The letter's signers included an all-star cast of Republicans and Democrats. Former Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan and Ben Bernanke, Laura Tyson, the top economic advisor in the Clinton administration, and Nobel Prize winner Joseph Stiglitz. Across the top, in a handwritten note to Trump, Wilbur Ross scrawled his disagreement. "Dear Mr. President, it is importantly the advice of the people on this list that resulted in our trade deficits. We cannot afford their policies. Best regards, Wilbur." The final 10 days of July 2017 left scars. On Thursday, July 27th, Trump had hired Anthony Scaramucci, a brash investment banker and another Goldman Sachs alumnus, as communications director over Priebus's strong objections. Scaramucci had done a victory lap of interviews and said publicly that Priebus would be asked to resign soon. "Reince is a fucking paranoid schizophrenic paranoiac," he said. Early the morning of Friday, July 28th, Trump's promise to repeal and replace Obamacare had failed in Congress. Trump blamed Priebus. He was supposed to know the Hill and have close relationships with the Republican leaders. No matter how Priebus tried to explain, Trump would not buy it. "You didn't get it done." That day, Trump flew to Long Island to give a speech. Priebus accompanied him. They had a talk in the private cabin at the front of Air Force One. Priebus had submitted his resignation the night before. He was fed up and knew he had lost his usefulness to Trump. Trump wondered who would be a good replacement and said he had talked to John Kelly, the Secretary of Homeland Security and retired Marine four-star general. "What do you think of Kelly?" Trump asked. "General Kelly would be great," Priebus said. Trump agreed and said he thought Kelly would be just right, but he said he had not offered Kelly the job. Priebus was concerned about the optics of his departure. "We can do it this weekend," he said, "or we can do a press release, or do it Monday. Whatever you want to do. I'm ready to do it however you want to do it." "Maybe we'll do it this weekend," Trump said. "What are you going to do?" Priebus hoped to rejoin his old law firm. Trump gave him a big hug. "We'll figure it out," he said. "You're the man." Air Force One landed. Priebus walked off down the ramp. Rain dotted his black SUV where Stephen Miller and Dan Scavino were waiting for him. He felt as good about the situation as possible. He got an alert for a presidential tweet. He looked down at the latest from @RealDonaldTrump. "I am pleased to inform you that I have just named General Secretary John F. Kelly as White House Chief of Staff. He is a great American." Unbelievable, thought Priebus. Is this serious? He had just talked to Trump about waiting. No one had expected Trump's tweet. When Miller and Scavino saw it, they hopped out of Priebus's SUV to get into another car, leaving the former chief of staff alone. As he shut the car door, Priebus wondered if maybe Trump had drafted a tweet and sent it accidentally. No, that had not happened. The conversation in the cabin was just one more lie. That night, General Kelly came to see Priebus. They had been in the foxhole together, but Kelly had privately criticized the disorder and chaos of the White House to Trump. Kelly had told the president he believed he could straighten the place out. "Reince," Kelly said, "I'd never do this to you. I'd never been offered this job until the tweet came out. I would have told you." It made no sense, Priebus realized, unless you understood the way Trump made decisions. The president has zero psychological ability to recognize empathy or pity in any way. Caught by surprise, Kelly had gone dark for several hours. He'd had to call his wife and explain that he had no choice but to accept after being offered one of the most important jobs in the world via tweet. Kelly said in a statement that day, "I have been fortunate to have served my country for more than 45 years, first as a Marine and then as the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security. I am honored to be asked to serve as the Chief of Staff to the President of the United States." In some respects, Priebus never got over the way his departure was handled. If you have no empathy or pity for anything or anybody, then that episode doesn't seem that abnormal, Priebus concluded, which is why Trump could call him 2 days later. "Reince, my man, what's going on? How you doing?" Trump didn't think they had a problem, so he didn't view it as awkward. As a general rule in relations with Trump, the closer you were, the further away you got. You started with 100 points. You couldn't get more. Kelly had started with 100 points in his jar, and they'd gone down. Being close to Trump, especially in the chief of staff role, meant going down in points. It meant you paid. The most important part of Trump's world was the ring right outside of the bullseye, the people that Trump thought perhaps he should have hired, or who had worked for him and he'd gotten rid of and now thought, maybe I shouldn't have. It was the people who were either there or should have been there, or associates or acquaintances that owed nothing to him and were around him but didn't come in for anything. It was that outside circle that had the most power, not the people on the inside. It wasn't Kelly or Priebus or Bannon. Months after his departure from the White House, Priebus made a final assessment. He believed he had been surrounded in the West Wing by high-ranking natural killers with no requirement to produce regular work products, a plan, a speech, the outline of a strategy, a budget, a daily and weekly schedule. They were roving interlopers, a band of chaos creators. There was Ivanka, a charming huntress dipping in and out of meetings or the latest presidential business. Jared had the same rights. Theirs was a portfolio without experience. Kellyanne Conway had or took license to weigh in on television or interviews almost at will, often without coordinating with the communications and press secretary offices that Priebus was supposed to control. Then there was Bannon, who had snagged a key West Wing office near the Oval and lined his walls with whiteboards listing Trump's campaign promises. He was a strategist in an operation that had none. He came forward to enter discussions with his fire when the nationalist populist agenda might be at risk, or seemingly at random, or when he needed something to do. Trump had failed the President Lincoln test. He had not put a team of political rivals or competitors at the table, Priebus concluded. "He puts natural predators at the table," Priebus said later. "Not just rivals, predators." These were people who had no experience in government, an astonishingly common distinguishing characteristic. They had spent their lives dabbling in political opinions and in policy debates, or were too young. In some ways, these four, Ivanka, Jared, Conway, and Bannon, had the same modus operandi. They walk into the West Wing. "You're not putting your weapon down," Priebus said. "I'm not either." Their discussions were not designed to persuade, but like their president, to win, to slay, crush, and demean. "If you have natural predators at the table," Priebus said, "things don't move." So the White House was not leading on key issues like health care and tax reform. Foreign policy was not coherent and often contradictory. "Why?" asked Priebus. "Because when you put a snake and a rat and a falcon and a rabbit and a shark and a seal in a zoo without walls, things start getting nasty and bloody. That's what happens." Chapter 29. On a weekend in mid-August, in the seventh month of Donald Trump's presidency, hundreds of white supremacists came into violent conflict with protesters in Charlottesville, Virginia, vividly underscoring once again the racial divide in America. Moving across the campus of the University of Virginia in a haunting nighttime torch walk on a steamy August 11th evening, echoing Germany of the 1930s, around 250 white nationalists chanted, "Jews will not replace us," and the Nazi slogan, "Blood and Soil." The next day, following brawls between white nationalists protesting the removal of a statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee and counter-protesters, one of the white nationalists drove his car into a crowd of protesters, killing a woman and injuring 19 others. Images of snarling, tiki torch-bearing white men in polos and khakis and video of the vehicle brutally scattering pedestrians became a major television and news spectacle. On Saturday, August 12th, Trump was watching Fox News from his golf course in Bedminster. At 1 p.m. on Fox, a Virginia State Police spokeswoman described the melee. In the crowds, on all sides, they were throwing bottles. They were throwing soda cans with cement in them. They were throwing paintballs. They were fighting, breaking out and attacking one another, launching chemicals into the crowd as well as smoke bombs. At 1:19 p.m., Trump tweeted a call for calm. "We all must be united and condemn all that hate stands for. There is no place for this kind of violence in America. Let's come together as one." Later in the afternoon, at a routine veterans bill signing, Trump had a script that was all condemnation that ended in the word violence. Trump said, "We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence." But he departed from his text and added, on many sides, it's been going on for a long time in our country. Not Donald Trump, not Barack Obama. This has been going on for a long, long time." He then picked up the text. "It has no place in America." Trump touched a nerve with the phrase "many sides," suggesting an equivalence between the neo-Nazis and those who opposed white supremacy. Biting criticism of the president spanned the political spectrum, including many Republican Party leaders. "Very important for the nation to hear at POTUS describe events in hashtag Charlottesville for what they are, a terror attack by hashtag white supremacists," tweeted Senator Marco Rubio. "Mr. President, we must call evil by its name," tweeted Cory Gardner, Republican senator from Colorado. "These were white supremacists, and this was domestic terrorism." "My brother didn't give his life fighting Hitler for Nazi ideas to go unchallenged here at home," tweeted Senator Orrin Hatch, normally a reliable Trump ally. In a statement, Senator John McCain called Charlottesville a confrontation between our better angels and our worst demons. White supremacists and neo-Nazis are, by definition, opposed to American patriotism and the ideals that define us. House Speaker Paul Ryan tweeted, "White supremacy is a scourge. This hate and its terrorism must be confronted and defeated." Mitt Romney tweeted, "Racial prejudice, then hate, then repugnant speech, then a repulsive rally, then murder. Not supremacy, barbarism." Republican Senator Lindsey Graham appeared on Fox News Sunday and said that the president needs to correct the record here. "These groups seem to believe they have a friend in Donald Trump in the White House," and, "I would urge the president to dissuade these groups that he's their friend." Vice President Pence added, "We have no tolerance for hate and violence from white supremacists, neo-Nazis, or the KKK. These dangerous fringe groups have no place in American public life and in the American debate, and we condemn them in the strongest terms." News coverage zeroed in on Trump's clear reluctance to condemn the white supremacists. Some noted he had squandered an opportunity to snuff out suspicions that he harbored sympathy for the white supremacists. Kelly had set up a senior staff meeting by secure teleconference for 8 a.m. on Monday, August 14th. He was in Bedminster, but most of the senior staff was at the White House in Washington. Something was wrong with the audio on the secure teleconference equipment, and the start of the call was delayed. "Fuck it," Kelly said after about 30 seconds. "We're not going to do this." He stormed out, causing considerable chatter among the staff about his hot temper and hair trigger. The next day, there was another glitch. "Screw this," Kelly said. "Fuck it. Take the people off the conference line. We're just going to have the meeting with the people who are here." Rob Porter was in Bedminster with Trump and joined a coordinated effort to clean up the mess with a new speech on Charlottesville. A draft had been written by White House speechwriters, and Porter had the draft for Trump to give at the White House the next day, Monday, August 14th. The intent was to show the president as a constructive, calming force. Porter handed the draft to Trump on the flight back to Washington on Air Force One. The two worked through it. The president did not like the tone. He didn't want to sound like he was capitulating to political correctness. Porter and Sarah Huckabee Sanders, now the press secretary, had agreed that they needed to present a united front to get the president to give another speech. "I think it's really important," Sanders told the president, "that you are able to speak directly to the American people, not through the media filter, so that you're not misunderstood on this, and so that people at CNN and MSNBC, whoever it is, aren't able to suggest that you say and mean something different than what you do. You need to be very clear about this, and the best way to do that is for you, without the media filter, to be very precise about it, very direct. And then that way you're able to do that without the media twisting it." Trump defended what he had said. "It's not as if one side has any sort of monopoly on hatred or on bigotry. It's not as if any one group is at fault or anything like that. With the media, you're never going to get a fair shake. Anything that you say or do is going to be criticized." "You need to fix this," Porter argued. "You don't want to be perceived the way in which you're being perceived now. You need to bring the country together." That was the moral obligation. There's no upside to not directly condemn neo-Nazis and those that are motivated by racial animus. There is a huge rift in the country. Porter played heavily to the president's ego and desire to be at the center. He said that the president could be a kind of healer-in-chief, consoler-in-chief. "The country is counting on you rhetorically to help salve the wounds and point a direction forward," Porter said. The president could inspire and uplift. He could make this about him, the Redeemer. Trump did not push back, but he didn't say yes. Back at the White House, the West Wing was undergoing renovation. Trump and Porter went up to the residence. Porter pulled up the speech draft on his laptop. No printer was readily available, so the president and Porter worked from the laptop. Trump, who doesn't touch type or use a keyboard, sat behind his desk. Porter, next to him, scrolled through the draft and they cut and pasted. Trump said at one point, "I don't know about this." The draft was an attack on racism and referred to the necessity of love and healing. "I don't know if this feels right," the president said. It looked weak. He didn't want to apologize. "This doesn't feel right to me." Porter could see before him the two Donald Trumps, two impulses. He was clearly torn. He would not bend to political correctness, yet he did need to bring people together. He soon saw this and did not object to the language. "All right, okay," he said, as Porter scrolled through the draft, making changes that Trump approved. "All right," he finally said. "We'll do this." Porter could see the struggle. Not one to mask his emotions or conclusions, it was clear that Trump wasn't thrilled. Yet he wasn't upset. He wasn't angry. Porter had the final approved version of about 12 paragraphs loaded into the teleprompter. Trump was going to give it from the diplomatic reception room. Shortly after 12:30 p.m., Trump walked to the podium set between the American flag and the presidential flag. He grabbed the podium fiercely with both hands. He frowned. He looked grim and said he was here in Washington to meet with his economic team about trade policy and tax reform. He touted the strong economy, high stock market, and low unemployment rate, and said he was going to provide an update on Charlottesville. The Department of Justice had opened a civil rights investigation, he told the national television audience. To anyone who acted criminally in this weekend's racist violence, Trump said, you will be held fully accountable. Looking stiff and uncomfortable, like someone coerced to speak in a hostage video, the president went on. No matter the color of our skin, we all live under the same laws, we all salute the same great flag. We must love each other, show affection for each other, and unite together in condemnation of hatred, bigotry, and violence. We must rediscover the bonds of love and loyalty that bring us together as Americans. Racism is evil, he said, singling out the KKK, neo-Nazis, white supremacists, and other hate groups. We will defend and protect the sacred rights of all Americans, so every citizen is free to follow their dreams in their hearts and to express the love and joy in their souls. It was a 5-minute speech that could have been given by President Reagan or Obama. Make sure you tell him how great it was, General Kelly told the senior staff. He had been chief of staff less than 3 weeks. Steve Mnuchin and Gary Cohn were there to greet Trump at the elevator back to the residence. They showered praise on him. That was a great speech, Cohn said. This was one of your finest moments as president. It was in the grand tradition of unifying and taking the high road of racial healing. Later they told Porter they didn't know how he had managed to convince Trump. Porter felt it was a moment of victory, of actually doing some good for the country. He had served the president well. This made the endless hours of nonstop work worth it. Trump left to watch some Fox. Rob O'Neill, a former Navy SEAL Team 6 leader and author, generally praised Trump for being specific, but added, "That's almost an admission of, okay, I was wrong, and I'm sort of negotiating on this." Fox correspondent Kevin Cork said, "Some 48 hours into the biggest domestic challenge of his young presidency, Mr. Trump has made a course correction." The suggestion that he had admitted doing wrong and was unsteady infuriated the president. "That was the biggest fucking mistake I've made," the president told Porter. "You never make those concessions. You never apologize. I didn't do anything wrong in the first place. Why look weak?" Though Porter had not written the original draft, he had spent almost 4 hours editing it with Trump, providing the accommodating language. But strangely, Trump did not direct his rage at Porter. "I can't believe I got forced to do that," Trump said, apparently still not blaming Porter, but venting directly to him. "That's the worst speech I've ever given. I'm never going to do anything like that again." He continued to stew about what he had said and how it was a huge mistake. Chapter 30. The next day, Tuesday, Trump had meetings in New York to discuss his infrastructure proposal for spending on roads, bridges, and schools. In the afternoon, he was scheduled to give a press briefing in the lobby of Trump Tower. A blue curtain had been draped over the Ivanka Trump brand display in the lobby. Before going down, he asked for printouts of the really good lines from the two Charlottesville statements he had made. He said he wanted the precise language he had used in case he was asked. "Don't take any questions," all the staff told him with urgency. Trump said he did not plan on taking any. At the press briefing, he took questions, and the questions were about Charlottesville. He took out his Saturday statement. "As I said on, remember, Saturday, we condemn in the strongest possible terms the egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence." He left out the part about both sides, but this time he added, "The alt-left came charging at the rally. You had a group on the other side that was also very violent. And nobody wants to say that, but I'll say it right now. Not all of those people were neo-Nazis, believe me. Not all of those people were white supremacists by any stretch. Many of those people were there to protest the taking down of the statue of Robert E. Lee. I wonder, is it George Washington next week, and is it Thomas Jefferson the week after? Both had been slave owners, he noted. You really do have to ask yourself, where does it stop? He reverted to his earlier argument. There is blame on both sides. You also had people that were very fine people on both sides. You had a lot of bad people in the other group, too. There are two sides to a story. David Duke, the well-known former Ku Klux Klan leader, tweeted, "Thank you, President Trump, for your honesty and courage to tell the truth about #Charlottesville. The leaders of each branch of the U.S. military went on a social media offensive against their commander-in-chief in a stunning rebuke. Chief of Naval Operations Admiral John Richardson tweeted, "Events in Charlottesville unacceptable and mustn't be tolerated. At U.S. Navy forever stands against intolerance and hatred." Marine Corps Commandant General Robert B. Neller wrote that there is no place for racial hatred or extremism in @USMC. Our core values of honor, courage, and commitment frame the way Marines live and act. And Chief of Staff of the Army Mark Milley tweeted, "The Army doesn't tolerate racism, extremism, or hatred in our ranks. It's against our values and everything we've stood for since 1775. The Air Force and National Guard chiefs followed with similar statements. On CBS, Stephen Colbert joked darkly, "It's just like D-Day. Remember D-Day? Two sides, allies and the Nazis? There was a lot of violence on both sides, ruined a beautiful beach, and it could have been a golf course." Former General John Kelly had stood in the Trump Tower lobby as Trump took questions with a grim look on his face. Colbert said, "This guy is a 4-star general. Iraq, no problem. Afghanistan, we can do it. 20-minute Trump press conference? A quagmire." Porter had watched from the sidelines in the Trump Tower lobby. He was in a state of shock, shattered and in disbelief. Later, when Trump brought up the second speech to him, the staff secretary said, "I thought the second speech was the only good one of the three." "I don't want to talk to you," Trump responded. "Get away from me." Kelly later told the president that because he had made three statements, now everybody has one to choose and it might work in the president's favor. Maybe it's the best of all possible worlds. He said his wife liked Tuesday's statement and press conference, the third one, because it showed the president being strong and defiant. Kenneth Frazier, the head of Merck, the giant pharmaceutical company, and one of the few African-American CEOs of a Fortune 500 company, announced he was resigning from Trump's American Manufacturing Council, a group of outside business advisors to the president. "America's leaders must honor our fundamental values by clearly rejecting expressions of hatred, bigotry, and group supremacy. As CEO of Merck and as a matter of personal conscience, I feel a responsibility to take a stand against intolerance and extremism," Frazier said in a statement. Within an hour, Trump attacked Frazier on Twitter. "Now that Frazier had resigned," Trump wrote, "he will have more time to lower rip-off drug prices." The CEOs of Under Armour and Intel followed Frazier, resigning from the council as well. Still stewing, in a second Twitter swipe at Frazier, Trump wrote that Merck should bring jobs back and lower prices. On Tuesday, August 15th, Trump tweeted, "For every CEO that drops out of the Manufacturing Council, I have many to take their place." He called those who had resigned grandstanders. Trump's press conference proved too much for the members of the President's Strategic and Policy Forum, a second advisory board, and the Manufacturing Council. Throughout the day, the CEOs of 3M, Campbell Soup, and General Electric announced their resignations from the Manufacturing Council, as did representatives from the AFL-CIO and the Alliance for American Manufacturing president. Jamie Dimon, CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, told employees that the Strategic and Policy Forum had decided to disband. Trump preempted further resignations by abolishing both groups via Twitter. Rather than putting pressure on the business people of the Manufacturing Council and Strategy and Policy Forum, I am ending both. Thank you all. Most significant, however, were the private reactions from House Speaker Ryan and Senate Majority Leader McConnell. Both Republicans called some of the CEOs and privately praised them for standing up. On Friday, August 18th, Gary Cohn flew by helicopter from East Hampton, Long Island to Morristown, New Jersey, where it was raining heavily. He had to wait on the tarmac to get clearance to Bedminster. He was carrying a resignation letter. This was too much. Someone had put a swastika on his daughter's college dorm room. He headed to the clubhouse where Trump was going to address a member-guest tournament. Walking into applause, Trump shook hands and made remarks, reminding everyone he had won the member-guest before. Trump and Cohn took food from the buffet and slipped into a private dining room. "Mr. President," Cohn said when they were alone, "I'm very uncomfortable with the position you have put me and my family in. I don't want this to be a contentious discussion." "You don't know what you are talking about," Trump said. They debated what Trump had said and what he had not said. "Before you say anything further," the president said, "I want you to go back and listen to it again." "Sir," Cohn replied, "I've listened to it like 30 times. Have you seen the video, sir?" Cohn said. "No, I haven't seen the video." "I want you to watch the video, sir," Cohn said. "I need you to watch the video of a bunch of white guys carrying tiki torches saying, 'Jews will not replace us.' I cannot live in a world like that." "You go listen and you go read," Trump said. "I'll go watch the video." They agreed to discuss it after they had done their listening and watching. "I said nothing wrong," Trump said. "I meant what I said." "The Monday statement was great," Cohn said. "Saturday and Tuesday were horrible." The next Monday at the White House, Cohn appeared at the Oval Office. Ivanka was sitting on one of the couches. Kelly was standing behind a chair. Cohn was halfway into the Oval Office when Trump said, "So you're here to resign?" "Yes, sir, I am." "I've done nothing wrong," Trump repeated. "He was leaving because of your liberal Park Avenue friends. This must be your wife," Trump said, blaming Cohn's wife. Trump launched into a story about a great golfer. The golfer's wife complained because he was gone every weekend. So he listened to her, and now, Trump said, the once great golfer is selling golf balls and making no money, completing his blame the wife narrative. "Everyone wants your position," Trump continued. "I made a huge mistake giving it to you." The president continued with venom. It was chilling. Cohn had never been talked to or treated like that in his life. "This is treason," Trump said. Trump turned to trying to make Cohn feel guilty. "You are driving our policy, and if you leave now, taxes are over. You can't do this." Cohn had spent months working a tax cut plan and was in the middle of negotiations on the Hill, a massive, complex undertaking. "How could you leave me hanging like that?" "Sir, I don't ever want to leave you hanging. I don't want anyone to ever think I betrayed them. I have a reputation I care more about than anything in the world. I'm working for free here in the White House. It's not about money, it's about helping the country. If you think I'm betraying you, I will never do that." And relenting, he added, "I will stay and get taxes done, but I can't stay here and say nothing." Vice President Pence walked in and stood next to Cohn and touched him affectionately. They needed to keep Cohn, Pence said, but he understood the position Cohn was in. Yes, Cohn should say something publicly. "Go out there and say whatever you want," Trump said. "Mnuchin said something." Mnuchin had put out a statement. I strongly condemn the actions of those filled with hate. They have no defense from me, nor do they have any defense from the president or this administration." He quoted and commended Trump's initial response to Charlottesville and added, "As someone who is Jewish, while I find it hard to believe I should have to defend myself on this or the president, I feel compelled to let you know that the president in no way, shape, or form believes that neo-Nazi and other hate groups who endorse violence are equivalent to groups that demonstrate in peaceful and lawful ways." Trump cited others who had distanced themselves from him. "I don't have a platform," Cohn replied. "What do you mean?" asked Trump. "The cabinet secretaries had press departments," Cohn said. "They can go out and make statements whenever they want. I'm an assistant to the president. I'm not supposed to be making press statements." "I don't care," Trump said. "Go to the podium right now and make a statement." He was inviting Cohn to go to the podium in the press room of the White House. "I'm not going to do that, sir. That's embarrassing. That's not what you do. Let me do it my way." "I don't care what way you do it," Trump said. "I just don't want you leaving until taxes are done, and you can say whatever you need to say." "Do you want to see it before I say it?" Trump seemed to be of two minds. "Nope," Trump replied at first. "Say whatever you want to say." But then he asked what it might be. "Could we see it first?" Cohn said he would work with the White House Communications Department. On the way out of the Oval Office, General Kelly, who had heard it all, pulled Cohn into the cabinet room. According to notes that Cohn made afterward, Kelly said, "That was the greatest show of self-control I have ever seen. If that was me, I would have taken that resignation letter and shoved it up his ass 6 different times." A few minutes later, Pence showed up in Cohn's West Wing office. He reiterated his support. "Say whatever you need and want to say, and continue to serve your country," he said, thanking him for everything. Cohn chose to make his views known in an interview with the Financial Times. "This administration can and must do better. I have come under enormous pressure both to resign and to remain. I also feel compelled to voice my distress. Citizens standing up for equality and freedom can never be equated with white supremacists, neo-Nazis, and the KKK." Cohn could tell that Trump was angry because the president would not talk to him for a couple of weeks. At regular meetings, Trump would ignore him. Finally, one day, Trump turned to him and asked, "Gary, what do you think?" The inner administration shunning was over, but the scar remained. To Rob Porter, Charlottesville was the breaking point. Trump rejected the better judgment of almost all of his staff. He had done that before. His perverse independence and irrationality ebbed and flowed. But with Charlottesville, the floodgates just opened. For just the sake of a few words, he had drawn a stark line. "This was no longer a presidency," Porter said. "This is no longer a White House. This is a man being who he is." Trump was going ahead no matter what. As Porter saw it from up close, perhaps as close as anyone on the staff except Hope Hicks, the Trump election had rekindled the divide in the country. There was a more hostile relationship with the media. The culture wars were reinvigorated. There was a racist tinge. Trump accelerated it. Porter wondered if trying to repair any of those divisions after Charlottesville was almost a lost cause. There was no turning back. Trump had crossed the point of no return. To the Trump opponents and haters, he was un-American, racist. There was so much fuel on that fire already, and Trump had added so much more. The fire was going to burn, and it was going to burn brightly. It was now an almost permanent state of suspicion, disbelief, and hostility. It's just all-out war now. Chapter 31. In the midst of the Charlottesville controversy, Bannon called Kelly. "I know this guy," he said. "If you don't start having people in the White House covering for Trump, there would be trouble. You've got to cover for him." Republican Senator Bob Corker had told reporters, "The president has not yet been able to demonstrate the stability nor some of the competence needed to succeed in office." And Politico had run a long piece on Trump's anger issues, calling Trump driven by his temper and saying, "Anger serves as a way to manage staff, express his displeasure, or simply as an outlet that soothes him." "Not one guy in the White House at the senior level has come out and defended him," Bannon said. Bannon felt that Trump should be winning the messaging war. President Trump, by asking, "Where does this all end? Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln," connects with the American people. The race identity politics of the left wants to say it's all racist. Just give me more. I can't get enough of it. Vice President Mike Pence had dutifully retweeted some of Trump's more benign remarks and added, as at POTUS Trump said, "We have to come together as Americans with love for our nation and true affection for each other. Hashtag Charlottesville." Bannon told Kelly, "If he gets boxed in, you're going to have free shots on goal from the guys on Capitol Hill. You have to start protecting this guy." "Do you fucking want to take this job?" Kelly asked. "Excuse me? Do you want to be fucking chief of staff?" "What are you talking about?" Bannon replied. "Don't pull that on me. You know you're the only guy to do it." "Listen," Kelly said. "My problem right now is I think I'm going to lose half the guys here, and I could lose a third of the cabinet. You don't understand. This thing's on a knife's edge. People are not going to just tolerate this. This has got to be condemned. If you think you've got a solution." Bannon did not. But he did tell Kelly he was going to resign. "Look, I'm going to leave on Friday," Bannon said. Tomorrow would be his last day. "I think that may be best," said Kelly. But Bannon was worried about Trump's upcoming weekend at Camp David that would include the final NSC meeting before the Afghanistan decision. "Just make sure the president gets every option and detail." "I'll make sure that happens," Kelly said. That was his standard line. The president would get the full story and the full range of options. "Make sure Pompeo gets a full chance to make his pitch." Kelly said he would. Bannon knew Trump was heading toward a globalist decision. The forces of the national security establishment, led by McMaster, were setting him up. They were creating a record that Trump had been briefed fully about the potential Afghanistan threat as a base for future 9/11-style terrorism. If the threat materialized, they would leak to the Washington Post or the New York Times that Trump had ignored the warning. Under the plan for the NSC meeting on August 18th, Sessions and Kellogg would advocate pulling out of Afghanistan. CIA Director Pompeo would argue for expanding the CIA paramilitary role instead of additional troops, a position he and Bannon had crafted. McMaster would argue for staying the course, which meant adding 4,000 troops. Sessions began by noting that he had been on the Senate Armed Services Committee since 9/11. "I've always heard the same thing. We're 6 months to 18 months from turning Afghanistan around. Time and time again, the same. You guys have always been wrong. Look at the major decisions to add tens of thousands of troops by Obama," he hammered. "A major turnaround promised and expected. Always wrong. That's why we've been here for 16 years. The Taliban now control more than half the country. Withdraw now. Give it up." Kellogg concurred. "Gotta come home." Pompeo had gone through some come-to-Jesus sessions at Langley. The old hands reminded him that Afghanistan was the graveyard not just of empires, but of careers. The agency had spent years in a subsidiary role with the CTPT paramilitary teams, avoiding full responsibility. Afghanistan was the Army's problem, the agency old hands advised. Keep it that way. Another consideration? Under Pompeo's proposed plan, the Army would be in charge of the CTPT and would never give the CIA real control. There was no guarantee or reasonable expectation of success, and somebody's going to get blamed down the road. When it came time for Pompeo to make the case for the middle course, he reigned all over his own alternative. It would take us about 2 years for the CIA to get ready to expand its CTPT counterterrorist effort, he said. We're not physically ready and don't have the infrastructure. We don't have the ability to step in and co-run such an ambitious undertaking with special forces. The CIA assets in Afghanistan have atrophied. It's not a viable alternative today. McMaster was then up to make the case for staying the course and adding up to 4,000 troops. His key argument was that a major strategic objective was to prevent al-Qaeda or other terrorists from hitting the U.S. homeland or other allies. I'm tired of hearing that, Trump said, because you guys could say that about every country in the world. You keep talking about there's ISIS all over. They could be organizing an attack on us. We can't be everywhere. Trump exploded, most particularly at his generals. You guys have created this situation. It's been a disaster. You're the architects of this mess in Afghanistan. You created these problems. You're smart guys, but I have to tell you, you're part of the problem. And you haven't been able to fix it. And you're making it worse. And now, he added, echoing Sessions, you're wanting to add even more troops to something I don't believe in. I was against this from the beginning. He folded his arms. I want to get out, the president said, and you're telling me the answer is to get deeper in. Mattis, with his quiet style, had immense impact on the decision. He was not a confronter. As he often did, he adopted the approach that less was more. I think what you're saying is right, he told Trump, and your instincts are right on the money. But a new approach could work. Ending artificial Obama-style timelines and lifting restrictions on the on-the-ground commanders. Leaving could precipitate the collapse of the Afghan state. U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan had left the vacuum for al-Qaeda to create a terrorist sanctuary leading to the 9/11 attacks. The problem is that a new terrorist attack, especially a large one originating from Afghanistan, would be a catastrophe. He argued that if they pulled out, they would create another ISIS-style upheaval. ISIS already had a presence in Afghanistan. What happened in Iraq under Obama with the emergence of ISIS will happen under you, Mattis told Trump, in one of his sharpest declarations. It was a barb that several present remembered. You all are telling me that I have to do this, Trump said grudgingly, and I guess that's fine and we'll do it, but I still think you're wrong. I don't know what this is for. It hasn't gotten us anything. We've spent trillions, he exaggerated. We've lost all these lives. Yet, he acknowledged, they probably could not cut and run and leave a vacuum for al-Qaeda, Iran, and other terrorists. After the meeting, Sessions called Bannon. He spit the bit, Sessions said, using a term for an exhausted, worn-down racehorse's rejection of its rider's control. Who? Bannon asked. Your boy Pompeo. What are you talking about? That was the worst presentation I ever saw, Sessions said. He and Kellogg had done their best. I couldn't have been any better. Kellogg was fantastic. McMaster was actually better than he's ever been because you weren't around. The president actually said afterwards that I and Kellogg made the best presentation. But clearly, the president was looking for the middle option as an alternative. How bad was Pompeo? His heart wasn't in it. How could it not be? Bannon called Pompeo. What the fuck happened? We set this whole thing up for you to come and own it. I can take that building only so far, Pompeo said of the CIA. I've got other fights I've got to win. Pompeo reported what the senior officials at Langley were telling him. What are you doing? Pompeo was getting excellent reviews, and Trump liked his style. You're on a roll, but you're going to be held accountable for this. One person at Langley had told him, We spent 10 years in Washington making sure we weren't held accountable for anything in Afghanistan. Why are you volunteering? We never volunteer for anything. Don't worry about Bannon. He is a clown. He's crazy. This is the Pentagon trying to trap us because they want out too. Pompeo described the CIA's position. We don't have the apparatus to take command of this. This is something the Army's got to do. You're saying make it a joint venture. We don't have those kinds of resources. We don't have that kind of expertise on the scale they're talking about. We're not going to take responsibility. Are you going to take responsibility for Afghanistan? Because we're not going to win. You understand? We're not going to win. And that would be hard because Trump was saying, How come we're not winning? How come they're, the Taliban, blowing up guys? Bannon talked to Trump by phone. You know where I stand on this, Bannon said. I think eventually you're going to come to see the middle ground. You didn't hear the whole thing, Trump said. There's really a new strategy in there, and we're going to win. At the August 18th NSC meeting, Trump approved McMaster's 4 R's. Summarized in a 60-page strategy memo dated August 21st, signed by McMaster, they were formalized as reinforce, provide more equipment and training, but leverage support with conditions to drive reforms. Realign. U.S. civilian assistance and political outreach will be realigned to target key areas under government control, with contested areas considered on case-by-case basis. Reconcile. Diplomatic efforts will urge government to undertake broader efforts to foster inclusivity and political accommodation, promote elections, and conduct outreach of ethnic and regional power brokers. And regionalize. Work with regional actors. The memo said the meeting established that the goal in Afghanistan was to reshape the security environment, to limit the Taliban's military options, and encourage them to negotiate a political settlement that reduces violence and denies safe haven to terrorists. Trump authorized Mattis to designate the Taliban and the terrorist Haqqani Network in Pakistan as hostile forces. Buried in the 19-page section on integrated strategy was an admission. Stalemate likely to persist in Afghanistan, and Taliban likely to continue to gain ground. In the tradition of concealing the real story in a memo, win is unattainable, was the conclusion signed by McMaster. You're the first person I called, Trump told Graham. I just met with the generals. I'm going to go with the generals. Well, Mr. President, that's probably the smartest thing any president could have done. That was a hard one, Trump said. It's the graveyard of empires. It was a reference to a book by Seth G. Jones on Afghanistan. It's my luck the only book you ever read was that one, Graham joked. Trump laughed along. Off the record, Trump said to his senior staff on Air Force One, though there was no press present on Friday, August 18th, I just fired Bannon. Did you see what he said about North Korea and having no military option? Motherfucker! Bannon had just given an interview to Robert Kuttner of the liberal American Prospect, suggesting that Trump's belligerent language to North Korea threatening fire and fury was a bluff. There's no military solution here, Bannon said. They got us. He added, until somebody solves the part of the equation that shows me that 10 million people in Seoul don't die in the first 30 minutes from conventional weapons, I don't know what you're talking about. Trump was worried about a prolonged war of words with Bannon and upset that he wasn't going quietly. A nationally televised Afghanistan strategy speech